Hey guys, it's Matt here, the founder at Sweat Elite, and welcome back to the Sweat Elite podcast. This is another episode of Hang With, where I hang out with a professional runner, coach, figure of the sport. And in this particular case, these two guys I hang out with are all of those things, and also two friends of mine. Victor Smangs and Mads Tarsboll, welcome to the Sweat Elite podcast. Two legends of the sport, and I really enjoyed this conversation with both. Those not familiar, Victor is a distance runner from Sweden who started running seriously at the age of 33. He's now 38 and he just recently broke 29 minutes for the 10K. Mads is a exercise scientist and he is a coach. He's a master of exercise and sports scientist. And he has been coaching Victor over the last little while. And we speak in this episode all about how Victor improved his 10K performance from being, I would call, stuck on around the 29 and a half minute mark to progressing down to running under 29 minutes for the 10K. Victor spent quite a few years actually stuck right around that 30 low, 30 mid, 29 high mark until he changed coaches to Mads and they figured out how to improve his 10K time down to 28.57 that he recently ran over 10K on the roads. So this was a really interesting conversation to hear because I'm always curious about how people move the needle forward when they're stagnated on a particular time or a particular area in their performance. So I really enjoyed this conversation because they really dive deep into how they move the needle forward and brought Victor from being, as I mentioned, stagnated on around that 30 flat mark, it will take 30 seconds to run under 29 minutes for 10K. And of course, other performances in and around that have been improved as well. Before I transition over to this conversation with Mads and Victor, I'd like to say a shout out to the sponsor of the Hang With series on the Sweat Elite podcast. The sponsor of the Hang With series is Precision Fuel and Hydration. I've been working directly with them for over 18 months now, and their products, at least personally for me, are completely risk-free, and they are my favorite products and were even before I approached them and began working with them. And what I mean by risk-free is I tried a lot of different supplements before I approached Precision Fuel and Hydration, as in drink mixes and gels and so forth, and I found that the inconsistency in how I would feel in workouts, and very occasionally I get a bit of GI upset, was often there. The taste in many other gels, I just really struggled to find one that I liked. I thought many of them were okay. But the Precision Fuel and Hydration stuff just really nails it every single time for me. I never get sick of the taste of the gels. I never get sick of the taste of the drink mix. They've just absolutely nailed the taste of both of those things. And there's one particular product called the Carb Chews, which is almost tastes like a candy lolly little soft thing that you eat before ideally a hard workout or a race. It's got 30 grams of carbs. It tastes absolutely delicious. And it just sits really well on the stomach. I really like the Carb Chew. I like the caffeine gel and the regular gel and also the drink mix as well, even though they have many more products to check out. So if you're interested in learning more about Precision Fuel and Hydration, you can check the link in the description of this podcast episode. You will find a link that takes you directly to the website and gives you 15% off your first order. Or you can just use the code SWEATELITE at checkout to also score 15% off your first order. A huge thank you to Precision Fuel and Hydration. Do check them out. They are my go-to with fuel and hydration for training and racing, and I hope that you will use them too. That's about enough from me in this intro. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Victor and Mads. Victor and Mads, welcome to the Sweat Elite podcast. Excited to speak with you both because this is a bit of a unique podcast episode in a way. Not unique in a sense of you, Victor, being somewhat definitely in the elite phase now, having run sub 29 minutes for 10K, but also to have Coach Mads on the call as well to explain what you guys have worked on over the last little while and how you've enabled Victor to improve his 10K times. Guys, thanks so much for joining. Victor, I guess we'll start with you. How are you doing today? How's things? And then we'll check in with Mads.
Thanks a lot, Matt, too, for bringing us. It's always a pleasure to talk about running, and especially with you. We met a lot of times now, so it's familiar to speak about running with you. But I'm good. I'm happy. I just ran on the sub 29 at Trafford 10K. So I'm very happy with it. That was the big goal for this spring. So it's really nice and already done that.
For sure. Mads, how are you doing?
I'm really good. Thank you, Matt. And thank you for this opportunity. I need to mention that actually Sweat Elite, I remember when it came out, I don't know, it was like 4, 5, 6 years ago now, something like that.
Yeah, about 6 years ago.
6 years ago. And it's just so cool to see the development. In the beginning, it was some Instagram posts. Then you got the YouTube channel. Now you got a really big, even like a podcast channel. So just kudos for that. I know a lot of privileged runner cyclists who are listening here. So yeah, high five for that.
Thank you very much. So guys, my curious interest is, like Victor, you pointed out, we've run together. We've hung out a few times together.
And when I ran with you, it would have been about a year ago now, you were a 29-minute runner. And I was very impressed by the fact that you had reached this level, having started running at 33. And it was only in a matter of 3.5 years, I think, that you'd gotten down to well under 30 minutes, of which I've been running for 16 years and haven't managed to run under 30 minutes. So I was obviously quite interested. But you've been working with Mads, who I was familiar with. Mads and I have exchanged a few Instagram messages over the years. And so to see you guys work together and improve on this time to get down to sub 29 now, the more I dug deeper, the more I realized you guys have done a lot of testing. You've got a lot of different things in training, and this is what this conversation is all about. So Mads, I reckon we can start with you and just speak to, when did you meet Victor? And then we can move into how you, and then we can talk about the testing, and then we'll just take it from there.
Yeah, of course. I'm great. Actually, I think Victor and I have known each other from Instagram and like exchanging a few texts here and there. And then Victor, you ran Copenhagen, I lived in Copenhagen last year, the Copenhagen Half Marathon. And yeah, to be honest, it didn't go too well. Victor didn't have the best year last year. And then we arranged the meeting and we had a walk in the local park. I think we walked for, I don't know, 3 hours or something like that, Victor. And we just geeked out about running, mentality, testing, stuff like that. And then at that point, Victor, he was coaching himself. And then we made a deal that we were starting some consultations. We will make like a rough draft. Because last year, like when I looked over Victor's training and the things he told me, the load was too intense compared to what his body could handle. Just like the great Renato Canova, he's always saying that it's not the training you're doing. Training is the effect you're getting from training you're doing. So we are only after adaptation. That's what it's all about. I mean, everybody out there can run 100 miles a week or do some crazy interval sessions. But if they don't develop, it doesn't really matter. So Victor, as many people probably already know, he did a lot of double threshold sessions. And it can definitely work for some people at the moment, and we will get into that later. But we talked about that Victor's training load in general was a bit too high. So he actually got one rest day a week, like a complete rest day, just to let his nervous system adapt and be ready for what was coming up. And then we dialed down the intensity quite a lot, because in training, you have volume and you have intensity, and you basically, that's the two things you can manipulate with. But if the body is not ready to adapt to the load, then you're just putting more stress on top of a stressed body. And in the best scenario, you won't really adapt. In the worst scenario, you'll actually get worse. So we dialed it down quite a lot, and Victor began to get more volume, but at a lower intensity. And then from January this year, he came to Copenhagen and we tested him. And at that point, I knew Victor a lot better. We had been talking a lot. I could look into his training peaks count and stuff like that, look into his power duration curves and so on. And then we began to make a plan. And what was quite interesting was that at that point, we could actually see that Victor, he likes to post just like I do myself, lactate numbers and stuff like that. And many people, when they think about lactate, they think it's the same for everybody. Many people, unfortunately, still think about the 2 millimole threshold and the 4 millimole threshold. The thing is, it can work in science when you have to generalize a big population, but on the individual level, it doesn't really work. So when people, they saw Victor's values even beforehand, they were quite low, really nice. And people were like, whoa, you're in crazy shape. But the thing is, lactate only tells us a little bit of the whole physiological profile. What was a big missing thing in Victor's training was that his, let's call it anaerobic capacity, or let's say the capacity you have above maximal lactate steady state, was not so well developed. And for many people, I would say plus, I don't know, 90%, that's not a problem at all. Actually, I would say most people, most runners, most cyclists, they are, let's call it anaerobically overpowered, but aerobically underpowered. In Victor's case, that was not the case. So we had to fine tune that system a bit, because we knew that we had those goals especially in February and March, where we talked about it'll be quite cool if Victor did just a small indoor season, which was really new for him, because he's a long distance guy. He thrives in the long stuff, and that's also the goal of the future. But if you think about a power duration curve, and if people, they don't really know what a power duration curve is, you can also just think about, if you have the x-axis and you have the distances, let's say you have a 400 meter, you have 800 meter, 5K, 10K, and then the y-axis, you have the speed. Victor's power duration curve was quite flat. So what I'm trying to say is that in order to make Victor faster on the 5K and the 10K, we need to make him even faster on the 1500 and the 3K. So that was the first goal in order to set him up for the 10K. Very roughly said, we focused a lot on increases Victor's anaerobic capacity.
and we dialed down anything that wouldn't really contribute to his performance level. And you're welcome to elaborate on that or ask questions, Matt and Victor.
Yeah. So that's super interesting to me because in a way I'm going through a little bit of a similar thing, but this podcast isn't about me. It's about you guys in that trying to do a lot more faster work in order to improve that sort of anaerobic or very high end aerobic work. And so Victor, yeah, I'd love to speak to how that indoor season planned out in your mind. And then obviously the thing that I'm really wanting to dive into is the actual testing and what you learned from the testing and then what you applied from the testing. But yeah, Victor, let's hear about how you viewed that initial response to Mads telling you that it's probably too much that you're doing. Too much. I'd actually like to dive into that at some point in this pod about, I'm thinking Jakob Ingebrigtsen can handle these double thresholds, but he has been doing that since he was very young, right? So that might be different for someone starting running in their 20s or in their 30s. That's probably a whole other podcast in itself. But Victor, it'd be good to speak to how you viewed that initial conversation and then how the indoor season went, and then we'll take it from there.
It was at that point in September last year after the Copenhagen half marathon, I was quite over being really bad that season. So that was really nice of Mats to have that long walk in the park for 3 hours and talk about very nerdy physiological stuff. And I was already like more or less bouncing ideas about raising my LT1 or the first threshold, because I felt like that was the problem, that I have fried the system a little bit. And I was really like, my aerobic capacity was really bad. But it was quite hard to let go of the double thresholds, because that was more or less my trademark that I built up my whole, what do you call it, like social media persona around. So that was a little bit scary with Matt, because I always tried to like, why don't we do it like this and keep the double thresholds? But Matt was more like, I think we should just stick to one, if you call it LT2, the classic threshold, like the Norwegian threshold, wherever you call it. And then just more or less just do top of zone two, LT1 stuff, and then just have one really like anaerobic capacity workout on Saturdays. This was when we really tried to work really hard, like short 200 meter repeats and stuff like that. So that was, I was quite scary too, but in that point I was just so bad. So I was like, anything that you think is good, I'll just gonna try it out.
Yeah, and that's interesting for sure, because when I ran with you, we spoke a little bit about this, not too much. And it's interesting what I said before, it's not necessarily that in my mind, Mads, you're the master of this. I'd love for you to correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think double thresholds can work, but it depends on the athlete and how undeveloped they are in order to make them work at the right time in their career, right? But Mads, you're the man here to speak to this. What exactly did you learn? What exactly did you guys speak about in more detail? And then what are the testing that you guys did in order to ultimately shift Victor's times from, because I remember very clearly, Victor, you being a little bit frustrated at the fact that you're running 30 minutes all the time. You'd run 29 minutes already. You were a little, you seemed, at least to me, both online and in person, to be a little bit frustrated at the fact that I'm doing this work that appears to be the right thing, but I'm just not getting faster. You're not really getting way slower either. You're just stuck at just before your PB. And then now you've broken through and run 28 minutes in a pretty quick period of time, to be honest. It's happened pretty quickly. So Mads, yeah, let's speak to this testing, what you guys learned, and then the juicy stuff in the training.
Of course, Jan, and thank you for that. When I test people, we all only know what we know. We get smarter over time. So maybe next year we will know something we don't know yet. But at this point, I find it quite important not just to look at lactate, because we need to remember the lactate, that's a byproduct of the metabolism. And I know you have spoken about lactate on this podcast, so people are probably a little bit familiar with it. But we need to remember that lactate, that's just a part of the picture. And when we are measuring lactate, we are measuring in the blood, but it's produced in the working muscles. So there's actually a time difference between when it's produced to we can measure in the blood, and we are only measuring the end product. So we don't know exactly what's happening inside the muscles. We also need to remember that lactate is really dynamic. And that means that stress will influence it, hydration, how much glucose you got before and stuff like that. So you can, it's more a concentration metric, because let's say that we're doing, let's say 10 by K at the same pace. We're below, let's call it LT2, just to use that name. And just a little short thought about that. When we talk about LT2, it's quite important to say that when we look into science, we actually have around 28 to 30 definitions of LT2. That's why I don't really like to only use that term. I'm all,
I don't really care about results, actually. I only care about how we can make a dent in the power duration curve of Victor. But okay, we looked, of course, at Lactate because Victor is using that a lot. And the good thing about Lactate is that if you get a lot of data points and Victor is using it basically at least 3 times a week, we have a huge set of data we can use. And then it's quite easy to dial in. Then we looked at what was happening in the worst working muscles by something called SMO2. It's a measurement of how much oxygen you have available in the working muscles. So you can actually look at it like this. When your muscles have to contract, when you begin to run, take a squat or whatever, people, they often think that if we do something, let's call it below 10 seconds of work, they call it a lactate work because they believe lactate is not created. But actually, even when we are resting here, if we took a lactate sample from you, Matt, or you, Victor, or myself, we would probably be around 1 millimole. So that already tells us that all training is aerobic, or I call it oxidative, and lactic at the same point. But when we look at the amount of oxygen we have in the working muscles, we can see the balance between how much oxygen is Victor utilizing from the bloodstream and how much can he deliver. And then when we look at, people have probably heard about Vitamax. And actually, I don't really care that much about Vitamax because it's not even a capacity. Maybe many people that talk about Vitamax, this is that capacity. It's actually a power value. Because if you can have, let's say, Matt, that you have a twin brother and you're like identical, you have the exact same Vitamax, but you can hold it for twice as long as your twin brother. That means it's not a capacity, it's a power value. You can be double as good as that guy, even though your little Vitamax is the same. What's more important to me when we are looking at Vitamax and those things is we get a look into Victor's respiratory system. That means how good is he at breathing? How efficient is he when we get up to higher intensities? And when we have all those factors combined, we can better triangulate where we need to set in. And we saw a few things. One is, like you spoke, we needed to increase Victor's anaerobic capacity because in the last step of the test, his levels were quite low. So that means even at that point, when Victor was running at, let's say, 1.8 millimole, just to say something, for many people, that would be really low. But for Victor, he was actually operating at a quite high utilization of his max. Another thing was that Victor was not that good at taking a lot of oxygen out from the bloodstream. A sprinter, just to set in context, the main difference between a sprinter, a 100-meter sprinter, and a marathon is that the sprinter is really good at emptying your tank really fast, and a sprinter will actually utilize oxygen really fast, where a marathoner is really good at delivering a lot of oxygen. So when Victor is running a 10K, it's not that specific to be really good at utilizing oxygen really fast. But in the training leading up to, because that was a limiting factor, I like to look into limiting factors. If we just take Vitamax, we have 3 limiting factors mainly. We have the respiratory system. That means how good is Victor at taking in O2 and how good is he at blowing out something called CO2. The other thing is the cardiovascular system. How good is Victor at delivering O2 or oxygen? And the third factor is, let's say, a look into the function of his mitochondria. How good are they at extracting oxygen? And we saw that Victor needs to be better at utilizing oxygen. And especially, we need to work at Victor's respiratory system. And that's something we will actually include a lot more over the coming months. Because if we can make Victor's respiratory system, how he's breathing a bit better, that means more blood can go to his working muscles, which are the legs, to propel him forward. The first thing we had to do was to work on those limiting factors. And then people probably think, but will you only work on those things? No, not at all. It's just, I believe the training should just be a small twist here and there so we can actually see what was working, what wasn't working. Because even when we have a full test of Victor, nobody will ever be able to guarantee the outcome. But we can, if we test quite regularly and we hold it up with Victor's subjective feeling, his training data, and so on, the chance of succeeding is a lot higher. So that was a bit different for Victor to work on and those things. And the reason we took double thresholds out, and sometimes we include them, is that the good thing about double threshold sessions is that you get really good at structuring your intensity. Because if you go, you guys know that yourself too, if you go too hard in the morning, you'll feel really smashed in the evening and you won't be able to go a few days later again. So I think people can learn a lot, but if we have a person like Victor with a quite low anaerobic capacity and he's doing a lot of double threshold sessions,
it maybe sounds a bit hard to understand, but we actually make his anaerobic capacity even lower. So it's all a balance. So when we had to get Victor into 10K shape, I don't care about what he could do in, let's say, a marathon or 1500 meters. Everything we do, we did was about making his as efficient around those 29 minutes as possible, like roughly said half an hour of work. But that was a little bit of a look into to the test.
Yeah. It sounds like you paraphrased about an hour or two into about 4 minutes there. So you did pretty well. Victor, I guess that's the very simplistic science explained, although we could go into greater detail, of course. Victor, how did the training plan change from the outside? So if someone was looking at your previous sort of weekly structure, which were, from what I understood, was mostly a Tuesday, Thursday, double threshold style thing, a lot of 1Ks, a lot of 400, sometimes 2Ks, you can talk more to that. And then that was twice a week. And then, yeah, so how has that sort of changed through the week? And speaking to any of Matt's points there would be helpful too.
Yeah, like when we started, we just worked on that. My aerobic capacity, like my values from, if you see, was really bad. So we just, in the beginning, we just did like really hard sessions on Saturdays. It was like 200 meter repeats with like very long rest. And then, so we just did, I think it's important, as both Matt and I talked as well, to still have that community intact in some way, because my training group in Stockholm that is quite successful now, a lot of people with the double threshold system, we always do like the same, like the Ingebrigtsen style training. So like we kept the Tuesdays, the 25 times 400 meter with the crew on Tuesdays, but otherwise all the other training was more individualized, more or less. But I think we more or less kept the Tuesday, but we were really much doing the first session was more dialed into the first LT1 kind of metabolism, like to be around that 1.0 millimoles. That is like more or less my numbers when I'm around that threshold, and then have the 25 times 400 in the evening. So it's been more or less that. And then it became like those indoor races and the Swedish champs and stuff quite fast. And we done a lot of harder stuff that has been there to more specific to 10K on during the week as well.
Those 200 meters that you mentioned, how fast are they? How hard are they? Do you prescribe a pace? Do you prescribe an effort? Is it 800 meter pace? Is it mile pace? And what recovery are you taking in between them? Because this is a workout, this sort of type of workout, which some could call zone 5, zone 6. Others would say 800 meter pace. Some would say anaerobic. There's many words you could use. What did that workout look like? Because when we spoke last year, I really did wonder if this was coming from a standpoint of gut feeling, and I didn't say it to you, but I thought that type of work might benefit you a lot. I didn't know for sure. I was just guessing. And it's interesting that you're doing it. I wasn't necessarily thinking 200 repeats. I was just thinking some really fast work. And so what does that workout look like more specifically?
That was really fun, actually, because both you and I were in Melbourne when I started to do it. So I started this session at the Collingwood track in Melbourne. So that was quite cool, like, yeah, to start it there. But I think like maybe Mats is better to explain exactly how this workout should be done.
Yeah, of course. And first of all, just to say, when we need to work on, let's call it, the anaerobic capacity, again, we always utilize oxygen. But when we need to work on the anaerobic system, it needs to be quite short, and we need longer rest, because people, they sometimes make the mistake that they keep the rest too short, and it feels really hard, but that's not the goal here. That's more for when you have to tune up for 1500 or 3K or something like that. So this workout Victor did is really inspired by a Belgian group and a coach I really admire, Tim Morio. A huge shout out to him. He's doing really good. He's training some guys who are really beginning to rock it. Including Isaac Kimeli, who just ran, I think it's 27:07 or something in the 10K. Robin Hendricks and those guys, so they are doing a good job. And they are working with a physiologist called Jan Albrecht. I'm quite inspired by. He's so smart. He's one of the most winning coaches in the world within swimming. The guy is, what I like about him is he understands the theory, but he also understands the practice, and it's quite cool when you combine those two worlds. So it's not coaches arguing with scientists and the other way around. But what Victor did was, often it was like 200 meter at, let's say, around 95% of max. So more feeling, somewhere between 27 to 29 seconds, not about maxing out. So it's not, I remember, Matt, when you had the great podcast with him, or the young miler, I forgot his name.
the American guy.
Hobbs Kessler.
Exactly, yeah. It's not real speed work where we're doing like 30, flying 30 or 40 meters. That will tumble it on. This is more about boosting an energy system. So it's more feeling and then directly into 1K around 10, 12 seconds slower than LC1 aerobic threshold. So first we produce a lot of lactate and then Victor Hill cleared afterwards. And then he had a passive rest of around 2.5 minutes. And we dialed that up from 5 reps to 8 reps over the course of some time. And then when those things were in place and things began to feel more natural for Victor, we could begin to do some more specific 1500 meter stuff, 3K stuff. Because I very much believe in if we just go from, let's say, base training to an indoor focus block and we don't really have transitioning, the risk of injuries or just the risk of a very unstable peak shape is not really predictable. So that was basically how we did it in the beginning.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I'd like to go back to something that Victor mentioned and also, as you mentioned, it's the LT1 work and where that fits into this schedule. Because being a marathon runner myself, I'm very familiar with the LT1 and this sort of effort of running. It's just a little bit behind LT2 and the lactate curves are a little bit different in everyone. But Mads far more about this than I do. So Mads, I guess you can start with talking about how you originally discovered Victor's LT1. And you can speak to LT1 however you like, and then how that's changed in Victor's profile moving forward. And if you think that's been a really big factor in the movement to go from repeatedly running 29 high, 30 low, and 65, maybe 64 for a half, to then seeing this 28-minute run come. And I don't know, I get the vibe there's faster times coming. I don't want to say that. We'll see. But the LT1 stuff was interesting. I noticed that on Victor's Instagram many months ago that you were starting to do that. I can't remember exactly how long ago, but I noticed that and thought, very interesting. Is Victor about to start doing marathon running? It doesn't seem to be. But obviously the incorporation into the 10K work is interesting because honestly, in my mind, I've wondered for a long time if LT1 work was overly beneficial for 5 and 10K. And I've recently learned that it absolutely can be if you apply it in the right way. And especially even down to 1500 meters, it actually can be. And I've actually proven myself wrong by doing a lot of research. So Mads, if you can speak more to LT1 and what you've been working on with Victor more specifically.
Yeah, first of all, I saw that Victor, he mostly did a lot of easy running. He did a lot of mileage in total, but he did easy running. And then the next thing he did was like basically LT2 stuff. So there was like a big gap between the paces. And I very much believe if we don't talk so much LT1, LT2 and stuff like that, that you need to touch on the whole aerobic system. It's quite important, not just for the physiological part, but also for the mechanics and stuff like that. But we saw that when you look at the difference between LT1 and LT2, or let's call it aerobic threshold, anaerobic threshold, at really high performing endurance athletes, it's quite important to make the gap really small because you can look at LT1 as the first point before we are not in a, let's call it cellular energetic balance anymore. So that means if people have tried lactate testing before, let's say you're walking and you measure out 1 millimole, then you're jogging, you measure 1 millimole, and then suddenly you begin to measure a little bit higher values. It's the point right before that, because when you begin to measure higher lactate values, that means you're relying a little bit more of what's called glycolysis. That means you're tapping more into the anaerobic system. So if people think about VO2 max, they can even just think about 3K pace. The smaller the difference we can make between, let's say, 3K pace or your max pace and LT1, the better, because that means we can make Victor's LT1 pace faster. We can save that, quote unquote, save that anaerobic system until the end. So we'll make him more efficient because that means he will have more mitochondria. He will be better at utilizing fatty acids so he can spare his carbohydrates. That will over time make his recovery a bit faster. And we can actually get more volume in because when people, they get to a certain level, LT1 will actually become quite taxing. I'm a little bit tired of hearing people talking about some two here and there all the time. I think it's the magic bullet because there are no magic bullets. We are all different. We need it all. It's just the distribution that differs. But for a normal person, a person who could run 25 minutes in a 5K or something like that, a recreational runner, LT1 will feel extremely slow. Maybe they even have to walk. So it doesn't really feel like training. But because Victor, he's getting better and a guy like you, Matt, that's probably around, I don't know, around marathon pace, plus minus, you're actually still trained. LT1 compared to LT2, because you're running a bit slower, the intensity is a little bit lower,
Of course, we need to get more volume in because that's just physics. In order to affect that power duration curve, we need to get more volume in. So we can't just trade and say we are doing a, let's say, 1 hour of LT2 work each week. Now we'll just do 1 hour of LT1 work. Unless, like in Victor's case, that the body is so stressed that it doesn't really adapt anymore. The beauty about LT1 work is that if we measure, I like to look into hormones and what's called functional medicine testing and so on, that if we are below LT1, it actually affects our nervous system in a positive way. So if people have heard about heart rate variability, if they've heard about stress hormones and stuff like that, if we measure people before, let's say an easy session below LT1, and then afterwards, we see a positive response in HRV, and we will see a positive response in the stress hormones. But when we go above that, like if we trade a lot above LT1, like many people unfortunately do a little bit too much of, then we are not adapting in the same way as we could. That's not to say we shouldn't do hard training, because all training builds upon each other. So for you, Matt, the how we would structure things will probably be a bit different compared to Victor, because you are a former pretty good 800 meter guy. So naturally, you probably have a lot of foot speed, and especially now you're working even more on it, you will get it back quite fast. I guess it'll be interesting to see. For Victor, it's a different story. So it's all about managing load and stress all the time, and then see how things will play out. Then regularly, like test things, have a dialogue about it. And then, of course, we can test all the things in the world we want. But in the end, the best marker of performance itself, that's quite important to remember, because there's a threat right now because of a lot when people, they get really geeky and scientific, but you can buy all kinds of tools in the world and you can measure so many things. But if we can't, if it's not valid data or we can't use the data, we don't really know how to analyze the data, just throw it away. A plain old stopwatch is better than having a lot of equipment if you don't really know how to use it. But if you know how to use it, then it's really beautiful, because that means that we can calibrate the internal feeling with the objective data, and then things begins to get really exciting.
That's very fascinating. Victor, I've got a couple of questions for you, but just firstly, Mads, for some reason, that was very interesting to hear. And for some reason, I think when you said the only thing that really matters is the performance, and if nothing else improves the performance, then you have to question it. I'm currently in some conversations with a person about a technique coach who looks brilliant online and he's very successful. But then I asked the question of, has he actually helped everyone improve their times? And the answer was no. So I was wondering, not sure if that's helpful. But Victor, I guess actually either of you could answer this, but I'll start with Victor. The LT1 stuff, how was that originally measured? How did you determine how to do that? Was it a pace? Was it a lactate monitor? Was it a heart rate? And then how has that changed over time? Because I remember one of your Instagram stories, Victor, where you shared an LC1 pace, and it was quite a bit slower than I would have thought it would be. But then I realized, okay, he's just started this process, so this pace is going to come down very quickly, because I know your LT2 is close to 3 minutes a K, right? Or it's more or less plus minus. And for me personally, my LT1 is somewhere like 310. My LP2 is like 325. Pretty close. Yours were very spread out. And so you're bringing that down now, from what I understand. But please, if you could speak to that and how you measure that and then where your head's at with that now.
Yeah, absolutely. That the interesting thing, if we dial back here like to a year ago, like I ran, that was like a PB that I ran 2023 in January in Valencia for the 10K was 29:30. And I did a lab test here in Stockholm before that run. So I had 300 per kilometer LT2 and the LT1. So that looked pretty like good. So that was like the outcome of that race, 29:30 would align with the test. But then after that test, I just started my coaching business. My Instagram became a lot bigger during that period. So it was a lot of stressors in my life. And when I got back to training, and my wife got deported from Sweden. She's an Aussie, just like you, Matt. So it was a lot of things happening there that was stressful for my body. That was like quite interesting, because then in like April, May, I did another test with like training as was, I was really suffering with the lactate numbers and everything. And then I did another lab test at the same clinic in Stockholm. And then five months later, my LT2 was 305, so 5 seconds slower. And then my LT2 was 305 and the LT1 has 340, so 20 seconds slower. So quite significantly slower. So I really didn't think about it too much, but I can really understand now that I can't run like even close to sub 30 with those numbers. but I trained kind of the same way with the double thresholds and everything. And then after the performance during Copenhagen in September, when I ran pretty poor, for I was aiming for around like sub 64 and I ran 66 high, I think. After the conversation with Matt in that park, I just did another like LT1 session around the park. It was some kind of like lake during the Copenhagen. And I couldn't even hold that 160 BPM. That was like my LT1 heart rate for that protocol. I had to slow down to 350. So that was really, my whole system was really overcooked. So that was more or less the start of the whole collaboration with Matt.
And then can we speak to a little bit more about where you've gone from there to now? Because obviously since September, you're running 66 high and only what, 7 months later, you've dropped your 10K time down to 28 minutes. Who knows that you can run for a half, but I'd be guessing 63. Although you probably, we can speak to what coming up racing wise soon in a minute, but what have you done to improve that LC1 more specifically? Is it just a lot more volume at LC1? And then how are you measuring that?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we kind of here when we in that meeting in the park, I went to Australia the day after for 6 weeks with my wife to see friends and family. So I started in Australia with just really putting in a lot of more volume around that LT1, because back then it was around 350 pace. So that was not as hard as it is right now when it's a lot better. So like I was just trying to because we said, me and the Matt, that we're going to be in contact when I got back from Australia. So I was just laborating to see like how much of that stuff I could squeeze in with proper recovery, more or less, to wake up every day and feel like I could do more of that stuff. So I didn't really have a specific schedule. It was more or less, how do I feel today? Can I squeeze in a little bit more in that intensity?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So Mads, I guess we could speak a little bit more to the point that you brought up it very early on in the conversation around glucose, how that affects these training sessions. And if there's any strength work happening here, I haven't actually specifically asked, but I get the feeling that we can speak a little bit to that in terms of what you think, how that might play into a profile such as Victor's and how much you may or may not be doing. But anything that contributes to these performances outside of the direct running itself, I think would be really good to hear from you, Mads, because I've had you on Instagram for many years. I can see stories and posts of you being very knowledgeable about this stuff. So learning these things is actually not only learning for the listeners, it's learning for me too. So I appreciate you coming on. But how does glucose, diet, I guess, in general, and strength work, and anything else that you think can go into working on these metrics for Victor or for anyone for that matter? If you could speak to that, would be really interesting.
Yeah, of course. And thank you for the question. First of all, when it comes to metabolism, that's actually just a breakdown of substrates. And with substrates, either carbohydrates or glucose and proteins, plus amino acids, and then we have proteins, carbohydrates, and we have fatty acids. And when it comes to exercise, it's mainly fatty acids and glucose that are important. We will burn a little bit of protein, but that's not that efficient. And when I'm talking about efficiency, we need to remember that people, they talk a lot about fat max here and fat max there and stuff like that. And it's good to be able to burn a lot of fatty acids. But the thing is, in order to get the same amount of ATP out, and just for the listeners, ATP, that's the only, let's say, currency the body can actually work on. So just because you're eating a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of fatty acids or whatever, it's all about breaking down and create ATP. So glucose, is more efficient than fatty acids. And with efficiency, it takes less oxygen to create the same amount of ATP. And that's actually why I know a lot of people have talked about it, but it's still very polarized, that you can take the most ketogenic person in the world, and you can take the most carbohydrate fit athlete in the world. And I'm 100% guaranteeing you that the carbohydrate fit athlete will not just win above the ketogenic athlete. He or her will completely destroy her, because it's just more efficient, because we only have a certain amount of O2 we can take in. The problem is sometimes that people, they eat too much carbohydrates compared to the little, because right now people are talking a lot about you need to take a lot of carbohydrates in while you're training. And yeah, that's also good, but we need to remember some of those like things we hear, that's from World Tour cyclists, and they are creating a crazy output for many hours. So when a normal person out there maybe has, like, cycling wise, let's call it an FTP or I don't know what, 240 watts, 250 watts, and you're comparing it with Pogacar, who's having plus 450 watts or something like that, he's burning a lot more energy. And
it's slower to create energy by burning a lot of fatty acids. So for Pogacar, it makes sense that he needs more glucose compared to recreational athletes in order to create that amount of power. What's also very interesting is that when we look at athletes and we look at their finishing times, the people, there's an old study where they looked at like the finishing times at Kona, Hawaii many years ago. The more carbohydrates you take in, the faster you'll end the race. I'm not saying just because you begin to eat more carbohydrates, you will run, swim or whatever faster, but there's a pretty decent correlation also when it comes to health, when it comes to bone health, and especially what's called RITs these days, which is like a relative energy deficiency. And just to throw it out again one more time, people shouldn't be afraid of carbohydrates. It's so important to get enough calories. And I would rather have that Big said he's 2 kilo above his racing weight most of the year than he is 2 kilo below, because it's, we should always think about input and output. If people only think about the outcome, and the outcome is to have a certain weight, then we shouldn't even worry about running competition. We could just get up on a scale and be as light as possible. We should care about what contributes to a perfect racing weight. And maybe a perfect racing weight is actually being a little bit heavier. You can produce a little bit more force, and you can actually accumulate more training volume over time. So regarding carbohydrates, that's not really a problem for Victor. We will begin to dial those things more in and look into his diet even more. But for many people out there, they should play around with like different distributions of energy intake, the training. And especially that when it comes to the marathon, it's like, let's call it a metabolically limited event. In that case, that what's limiting you is like, how much fuel are you basically able to take in? Because if you're only running on basically pure fat, either you will run really slow, or you will just feel like crap after, I don't know, 35 kilometers or so. But if you can just, let's say, 20 gram more carbohydrate in and oxidize it and use it per hour, maybe you won't even hit the wall, or maybe you'll hit it later. Things contributing to Victor's performance, actually, until this day, we have made it quite simple, mainly focusing about the running. Because Victor, he was a beast sprint last year, like I said. And I really believe one thing is the physiological part, but we also have the psychological part. And if we put too many things on top, I will happily do that. But if it's an overload to Victor's stretch level, then it won't really benefit us. Then it's important to note that Victor, he's actually a former hockey player, played ice hockey, and he can handle a lot. He can handle a lot of running volume, just not like Ken Lennon's who's doing 160, 170 miles a week, but Victor can handle a lot. So it's not a problem, but from now on, we'll begin to incorporate some more specific strength, some mobility and things like that. Just small twist here and there to see if we can make him a little bit more efficient, because it's also about how much can you recover from. If you already train, let's say 100 miles a week as a runner, or I don't know, 5 hours a week as a cyclist. If you put more things on top, if it takes anything away from the training itself, we need to look into if it's actually valuable. But the performance down the road, if it's valuable or it can prevent injuries, then it's all good. But if we could do something that will make Victor even better, then that's what we should do. And that's why I like only to incorporate a few things here and there, because else I won't know like a year down from this day what actually worked for Victor. But one thing we will also get to work a lot more with Victor, that's his respiratory system. Because from science, many people, they often think that we have big enough lungs, that our respiratory system, how we're breathing, is perfectly balanced. But actually, it's not. When I tell the athletes, I would say 70 to 80% of the athletes I'm testing, they have a respiratory limitation. That means that we can just improve that by doing some specific exercises. And we will also actually share out more about this the coming months. Then again, you will have more energy, more blood to the working muscles itself. So it's always about looking into what's the rate limiting factor and what's the most important to look at right now. When I've said that, there's no doubt about I very much believe in strength training, but I also believe that we can actually get away with a very small amount sometimes. And as runners, we are doing a lot of the same movements all the time. We're not producing that much force. So just a few times a week with some really heavy power focus weights, like even down to 2 reps or something like that, long rest, can do a lot when it comes to how we recruit muscle fibers, recruit motor units, and how well our nervous system is firing. And again, that won't affect Victor's physiology, but it will make him more efficient, so he's using a little less oxygen per step he's taking, and that will probably be faster it, with less energy demands, which is the most important.
This is really interesting. Thank you so much for sharing. There's a few other things I'd like to ask about, and I guess either of you could answer, you can decide, but Mads, you might be actually the better one to answer this, given that you are the sort of the expert in the testing side of things. For people listening, what can testing do for them? I'm looking at the triathletes and going, okay, all the best guys are testing all the time. So obviously there's something to it. I come from a standpoint of being a little bit cautious about overanalysis of things because I've overanalyzed things too much and I've gone backwards as a result of it. But that doesn't mean to say testing makes you overanalyze things. But what can testing do for people? What's possible for runners in this space? You own your own company, peakforever.com. We can put it in the description of the podcast episode as well. And there's a lot of information on there. But for people to get a bit of an intro, what does that look like in terms of if a runner's wondering, what can I do for testing to improve my own running? What would you say to that?
I would say it's a little bit like making a financial budget. You have how many money do you have to spend on food, on rent, on social stuff and things like that? So when people, they train, and let's mainly talk about recreational people here. They only have a certain amount of time they can train each week. They don't have 30 plus hours per week, plus recovery sessions, plus all kind of massages, stuff like that. So very shortly said, it's about making the things they're doing working more efficiently. Because if they're working on the wrong parameters, like many people, they're like two groups right now. Many sound too focused. And then we have all the people who are describing themselves in the gym on the track 3 times a week, just doing like balls out sessions. And I'm not saying one or the other is wrong. I'm just saying that they could probably learn from each other. So if we can look into the physiology and see, okay, actually, we don't have to care that much about Nutamax, or we don't even have to care that much about aerobic threshold, then we can put more of the focus on the things we actually need to work on. Because again, I don't care how many hours or how hard people train, I only care about that the input and what input training will become as efficient as possible. It's a little bit like investing money into the stock market. You don't just throw numbers, sorry, money here and there. You try to analyze a little bit. But the scary thing is that we have so many testing facilities and labs right now, and basically everyone can just buy it and they can have the most fancy equipment in the world. But if they don't know how to, one, make a good protocol and individualize that protocol, and they don't even know how to analyze the numbers, then I believe, like you said earlier, Matt, that it can create more confusion and questions that it can create answers. And that's where it's people, they need, it can be a little bit hard sometimes if you're not into it, but like a red flag for me, I often see in those labs, just for people, is that the testing they're doing, they're done in like 20 to 30 minutes. And they basically mostly focus on V2max. They only focus on the sexy metrics, like the high end stuff. They don't spend enough time on looking at the low end and moderate spectrum of the aerobic system. Also, for lactate, it's not just about how fast you're running. There's also a dimension called time. So if you try, just like UMass, you can do, let's say, 10 by 3 minutes, like where you increase the pace by a little bit on each step and measure lactate. And then you try to do 10 by 8 minutes, I will guarantee you at some point, the numbers will be a whole lot different. Because like we talked really about, lactate is produced in the working muscles, and it takes a bit of time before we'll get out into the bloodstream. So often with the short test on like short range testing, people, they will get artificially high numbers, high speed zones or heart rate zone compared to what they should actually train at. You're more than welcome to dig more into it if I should elaborate on something. Yeah. But that's, for me, a short answer.
Yeah, no, very well summarized. That's a very paraphrased, very complex background to that answer, I'm aware, because I've read through your website quite a bit in the last 24 hours. And to be honest, I consider myself pretty knowledgeable in running, but there's some things here that I'd love to learn more about. Definitely an open-ended invitation for you guys to come back on in a few months to talk more about the findings of Victor's movements in terms of performance. And the next thing I'd like to ask about, I'll start with Victor. And Victor, you can handball this off to Mads if you feel like he might know more. But I think, Victor, you've made a name for yourself for many reasons, but one big one being that you started running very seriously at the age of, I believe it was 33, correct me if I'm wrong, plus or minus a year. And within only a few years, 4 or 5 years, you're at 28 minutes. And I think if you told someone that's running at the age of 29, 30 and thinking that they're about to get worse, they might find that whole profile very interesting and very inspiring. Speaking to training age and chronological age, Victor, let's start with you and Mads can take over if he likes. But How do you see that, Victor, yourself? And what do you think that you've learned over the last 5 years since you started?
But I definitely feel like I have never felt at any point, at any training session ever, that I feel like I'm getting older, so I can't keep up. It's just crazy because I just feel, except for last year when I was really bad with the whole that we just spoke about, I just feel like I can feel in sessions now, because I feel like how my progression at work, if you do the 25 times 400 or whatever, you start to feel like this pace doesn't feel that hard anymore. Like, even though the lactate numbers could be a little bit high, but I have kind of had done sessions that is in paces faster than the 28:57 that I did in Trafford now. When I felt like faster paces than that, it doesn't scare me that much. I feel like I could probably be there in the future if I just get a little bit of a better aerobic capacity. So I have right now, I totally understand I probably can't be 50 and just be running 27. But like for now, I feel like definitely feel like I have another 5 good years of improvement left.
It might be all in your head, the age. I think it might be just, if you think you're getting old, maybe you are getting old, but if you don't worry about it, then you're not getting old. Mads, if you can stick a little bit more to the sort of chronological age versus training age, that's interesting to me. I'm almost the same age as Victor. I'm 37. I'm not too worried about slowing down, but eventually maybe it will happen. But Mad, any more insights in that would be good to hear.
Let's say we have a run at the same level as Victor, also a sub 29 guy, and quite similar in other distances. But that guy had been running since he was 18 years old, 15 or whatever. That means that his training age, how many years he has been training for running, is quite high. So in theory, he can't really improve that much anymore. But because Victor is training quite a lot, it's not like he can suddenly just bump up his mileage with 100 kilometers a week, unless his name is Cam Levins. But what is interesting is that we know, just if you look into the great former marathoner who had the former world record, Paul Radcliffe, there's a really great study done on her where we saw over time that her VO2 max got worse, but her lactate thresholds, LT1 and LT2, got better, and efficiency and running economy got a lot better. So the beauty about running was, because Victor, he haven't been running for that many years, just his mechanics, how efficient he's running, his body isn't running, how much oxygen he's using, can still become better, even if his physiological parameters begin to go down. Because again, we need to remember, it's not lab testing, it's not about the numbers, it's all about trying to guide the training so Victor can run even faster. Then one of my main goals is, we can talk about that next time even more, but is to bridge the gap between, let's call it peak human performance, and then what I call peak health. I'm very much into what's called functional medicine. And if we can look into Victor, like his digestive system, his hormonal system, his amino acids, his fatty acids, stuff like that, and we definitely have things to work on there, then I also believe, then it doesn't matter if Victor get, not when he get 1 year older, 2 year older, 3 year older. At some point, like you said, Matt, it's all about damaging control. But I truly believe that the coming years that we can still improve Victor, and especially if we have some low-hanging fruits when it comes to his health, that doesn't mean he's sick at all, but just in order to handle that much mileage, in order to handle that much intensity, everything needs to be at 100%. And I believe many athletes can optimize a lot more than just thinking about carbohydrates, proteins, veggies, and stuff like that. And it's good they're doing that. And the basics, you just have to put that out, the basics are the most important. Like I always tell people, and I don't know if you have a sponsor here, but don't use money on recovery boots if you can just sleep for 20 minutes more. Those 20 minutes more each day will do a lot more for you. So basic first, and then we can dial in the specifics. I don't even doubt that Victor will be better over time. How fast, nobody knows, but we'll see.
We do not have a recovery boot sponsor, so you don't have to worry about that. And I definitely agree with you on the point. Victor, I've got a final one for you, and Mads can shadow if you like, but 28 minutes now for 10K. I get the feeling, Mads gets the feeling, you get the feeling, there could be a 28 mid, 28 low coming in the near future. I wonder, is 10K what you eventually want to do? Because 30 to me tells me a 210, 211 marathon, maybe 29 is possible. Does the marathon interest you at some point? I know right now you haven't run, I don't think you've run one, I'm pretty sure. I've seen you run some halves, but what do you think about the marathon? And is the 10K, obviously right now the 10K is your focus, right? And that makes sense. But my brain goes to 38, you're still improving the 10K, but is it of interest to run at the European champs in the marathon at some point, or to actually run a good marathon? Because There's not a lot of guys outside of Africa that can run 2.9, 2.10, and your profile is trending in that direction. So what do you think about the marathon?
Yeah, I feel like, to be honest, the marathon is really important for me. That's why I also want to. I am very good. I'm a numbers guy. So I know the guys, they're the best in Sweden right now. Unfortunately, there's so many good people that are good in Sweden right now. So I know what their 10K times are. So to represent Sweden and put on the jersey, that would be magical. I haven't even entertained those thoughts yet, but it's getting closer. But unfortunately, we had Suldan Hassan doing 2:07 here last month. And we have, I feel like in my head, I can probably have 10 people in Sweden that could do 2:09 and faster. So it's a very hard team to, maybe you can have a look, but I don't know if it's any other team in Europe right now that is harder to get into than the Swedish marathon team.
Okay,
I would say.
So I'm going to be honest. Yeah. I didn't realize it was that strong. I was completely oblivious to that. I'm looking at Australia and the US and noticing not a lot of guys under 2:10. And so my apologies. I knew that there was a 2:7. I knew there was a couple of 2:9s, but that's interesting to learn. So I feel like I was a little bit uneducated asking that question. I apologize, but even still, does the marathon interest you? I guess is the main question.
Yeah, it definitely does. I feel like I could do, with the profile I have, I think the marathon. The thing is, I really want to do a good debut. There was like one of a marathon runner called David Nilsson here from Sweden. It's really good. Yeah. 10-2 guy. He was advising me, I think that you could do the fastest marathon debut in Sweden. I think that should be something you should go for. Until Suldan Hassan now did 2:07, so last month. So that's probably going to be quite hard to do that.
Yeah, you might need a sub-28 10K before you go after a 2:7, but who knows? Maybe you'll be there. Mads, what do you think about Victor in the marathon? I've got to ask, I think because I do know a large audience here is marathon, half marathon focused. And I know Victor's run a super quick half, but how do you see the current values in testing relating to Victor in the marathon?
I think it's very important, again, to dial in for everything. And right now, actually, because again, people are probably wondering, what does Victor do to Max and blah, blah, blah. I understand that totally. It's actually not that high. It's actually, let's say, below average compared to how fast it's running. It's a little bit, if you compare the great legend Steve Prefontaine, he had a high view to Max compared to the legend Frank Shorter. They were basically around the same level, plus minus at the short distances. But the difference in view to Max was really big. But Richard, he's really great at it. He's very efficient. And with efficient, he can run quite fast with low lactate numbers. But he also doesn't use that much oxygen. And that's a great thing for a marathon. Another thing is, and that's where just body composition comes in. I'm a tall guy. Victor, he's smaller than me. So the lower the body weight, like, again, that's not to say people should go down in weight unless they're overweight. But the lower the body weight, that means that you will come off with heat better. And our body is actually not that efficient. If we measure power, wattage, or just running speed, if we read, let's say, 200 watts on our cycling computer, we are actually creating around 800 watts of heat, pure heat. So that means the bigger we are, the more heat we have to create. So the smaller you are in the marathon, the better you are in controlling the temperature and the less fueling you have to get in. I truly believe Victor, again, if you look at his performances, now the freak is getting better, but it's not like he's the next superstar. Don't get me wrong, Victor, in the 1500, the 3K. So we need to make those things faster, but compared to many people, The drop in the acceleration curve, that means the difference, let's say, between his 3K and the 10K, and then we will see over time the health and marathon is actually not that deep. So it's a bit of a flatter curve, and that's positive. We want that in the endurance events. When that's said, and you know that, Matt, the marathon is just a different beast. Fury, we have seen people in the US running like sub 27, 30s, and they can't even break 2:12. I believe Victor can be good, but I have absolutely no clue before we see it.
Great answer. Guys, I really appreciate your time. I'd like to finish off by just saying, where can people follow you? Where can people find out more about what you both do? Mads, we'll start with you and then we'll head over to Victor. I know Victor's big on Strava, big on Instagram, but I'd like to learn more. But Mads, if people are curious to learn more about what you're doing, where can they find your updates?
I would say it's probably mainly on Instagram. I'm throwing a lot of stories out. I'll be better. I need to learn from Victor creating reels and posts and stuff like that. That's Mass Taskball, maybe we can put it in the description because my last name. And then I have the company Peak Flavor, and I will actually try to make try to make it in English, and I will definitely update it so people can look there. So either the website or Instagram, I'll say.
Google Chrome does translate to English now, which is how I read it. It's not not too bad with the Google Chrome.
I was going to say I was really impressed though, but now I know why.
Yeah, my Google Chrome has an, I think most of them do have an extension that just automatically translates. I think it's 98% accurate. Victor, where do people find your updates? I love following you on Instagram. I think mostly because you're just brutally honest. I think last year you posted an Instagram story, which I loved. You were like, guys, I'm just feeling really, I'm struggling right now. I'm really tired and I need to take a break. And I was like, good on you, man. Just tell everyone what the real world's, because we're all like that at some point. But where can people follow you?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Matt. That was nice to hear. But it is the Instagram and Strava now. Like, I really try to be as transparent as possible, tell both sharing my bad days and my good days. And like race experiences, putting out the numbers, even though I'm performing bad. But I really hope that we can get some kind of company or sponsor to. I feel like it would be, I know that a lot of people have written to both me and Matt about which you guys should really be on YouTube. And yeah, Matt, how hard it is to have a YouTube channel. So that is a lot of time to put in. So you probably need a good sponsor to make that happen. But that would be, of course, longer content with me and Matt would really like to share the knowledge to as much people as possible.
All right, we'll talk after this conversation's finished about maybe how to make that happen. I have some ideas, but of course, the right contacts and the right sponsors, as you said, are the key. But really appreciate you guys, your time. We'll check back in a couple of months. I'm really curious to actually get you back, guys, back on in maybe May or June after some more races. But thank you guys so much for joining, and appreciate everyone for listening in.